This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, and one way or another, we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Anne Lamott, author of the nonfiction book Somehow, Thoughts on Love.
Deep calling to deep is the relationship of a good writer calling out to the audience, and that's love. And it's saying, you got a minute, I got a story, I think you might find it interesting. And a reader trusting particular writers enough to say, yeah, and sitting down, and then you start the process of the writer tells you a story, and somehow they've helped you care.
We'll be back with Anne Lamott after these essential words. Here's what I want to say about pitching for patrons. It's my least favorite thing to do, but it supports my most favorite thing to do. Share this podcast with the world and with you. And so I'm wondering, do you get something out of this? Do you listen more than 8 times a year? Is there something of value for you in these episodes? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then why not support this content by becoming a patron of First Draft? You can do that at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Here's the common conversation I have at parties. Okay, I don't really go to parties because I'm always doing this, but this is a common conversation I have about this podcast. So why did you start this? Someone asks. I don't really know. I was a radio reporter for years and getting my MFA in fiction, and I missed interviewing people. So I combined these two things and started this show. I didn't really think about what I was doing. I didn't have a master plan. It just seemed like a fun idea at the time. And I still don't really have a master plan, but it's been 10 years that I've been doing this. So then they ask, do you make money? And the answer is, I have some incredible patrons, but they come and go. And lately, for whatever reason, and this is really vulnerable here, more people have left than joined. I can't pretend to know why, but in exit surveys, they usually say it's for financial reasons and that they really love the content. And I get that. I really get it, because there are expenses to make this podcast and financial needs to make this podcast. I will say that every hour I'm working on this is time I'm not spending at a quote-unquote paying gig. Times have changed since we got our newspapers on our stoops twice a day. You know that. Our content comes from all over the place. But in this case, there isn't an AI behind this, just an I, which is me, Mitzi, all by my lonesome, doing the research, booking the guests, reading their work, conducting the interview, uploading it into the podcast world, and then doing it again and again and again, more than 50 times in the last year. I produce one episode a week, and that is on top of all my other jobs, which is why I don't go to parties or really do anything on the weekends except for this. So if you value this podcast, please consider supporting it with a financial contribution. Membership starts at $6 a month and includes extras like writing tips, cuts that didn't make it into the final show, end of the year thank you gifts, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and more. I think in this world, we have to support what we love and there is an energy there that comes back to us. So please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters and become a supporter of First Draft today. It still doesn't make a shred of sense that I'm doing this podcast. Still, here I am after a decade. But Rumi said, set your life on fire. Seek those who fan your flames. So I'm inviting you to warm yourself by this fire and bring your fan along. Patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And on to the show. My guest today is Anne Lamott, author of 20 books, which include the novels Hard Laughter, Blue Shoe, and Imperfect Birds. Her nonfiction titles include Operating Instructions, Bird by Bird, Almost Everything, Notes on Hope, and Dusk, Night, Dawn. She has been awarded the Guggenheim Fellowship and was inducted into the California Hall of Fame in 2010. Her new nonfiction book is called Somehow, Thoughts on Love, and contains 10 essays and a coda on various topics related to love and connection, spirituality and grace, vulnerability and courage. Her essays look at the transformative power of love in our lives and the way it surprises us and forces us to confront uncomfortable truths. Her essays explore partner love, parental love, friendship love, and community love. We began with me asking Anne Lamott why it was time to write this specific book.
Oh, I love that question. Well, I have felt increasingly more worried and sad for my son and grandson as the world grows scarier and scarier, both with the climate catastrophe and with the threat to democracy. And I decided to write a book that had every single thing in it that had ever helped before. When we had been in hard times or disasters that had helped, and that would almost certainly help again for my son and grandson after I'm gone. And everything I wrote about had some way or another something to do with love.
Did you then collect things that you had written before and kind of tweak it? You started?
No. I really started from the beginning. I started, like I start everything, just scribbling down everything that is on my heart or in my head or memories or stuff I haven't written about. And I always do a pre-draft. And it's just this scribbly list of stuff I might want to write about and stories and memories that I haven't ever told before that I think are important, or not important in a meta sense, but in the sense that to me and maybe to my readers. And so when I decided to write this book on love for Sam and Jax, the scribbles were more specific to things that had ever, either in the way past or recently, helped me and the community through really hard times.
One thing I noticed in there, although of course these are all meditations on love, that there were these themes that came out repeatedly for me that I saw, which have to do with community, grace, fragility, mortality, human connection, and then like the beauty of small wonders. Does that make sense to you when you hear that list?
Yeah, I would say those are the themes in every book I've ever written.
Can you talk about that idea of these small kind actions? I mean, one of the things you mentioned was like your own worry for the planet, and that you have a time in there when you're teaching Sunday school and you're talking about the parents of the kids who are just forlorn about the world that their kids are going to inhabit. And you kind of come down to the idea that it's really these small wonders, like looking at the miracles in the face of despair that are small, and finding the small kind actions to find joy.
You know, I started out 46 years ago with a novel about my father, who had been diagnosed with terminal brain cancer with a melanoma. And my novel's called Hard Laughter. And that was where I first started writing about being faced with catastrophe, really with the end of the world. But so many of the things that I felt in me that wanted to get written had to do with these small moments of grace or humor in the face of pretty unfunny stuff, and not just gallows humor, but sweeter humor than that, and just goodness between people that saved the day one day at a time. And after that, it was just something that, A, I love to come upon when I'm reading, and B, that just are so important to my sense of spirituality and my belief that the world tilts towards the good, even when it might not on the surface look like that. So Mother Teresa said something I love, which 1,000 years ago, which was that no one can do great things, but we can all do small things with great love. And I identify so much with, A, you know, wanting to do big, great things, and I can't, and I don't, and I do small things. And it's the small things that people have done for me when I've been really stuck, really defeated, just worried about the coming days of the ice melting. It's the small things that people have done or said or turned me on to or exhibited that have lifted my heart and spirit. So those tend to be what I have to pass along, is the message of look for these, you know, be on the watch for these. The daffodils are just coming up right outside my window. And they're such a great little sight gag with their big noses, and they're so pretty. And that's what's going to help me right now. It's not going to be scouring the news for something that was a little bit hopeful. There was a priest who helped AA get off the ground in the 30s. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he was Bill's friend. And he said to Bill, "Sometimes I think that heaven is just a new pair of glasses." And that was something, when I heard, I felt like I was standing next to a Buddhist gong. It was 1986 when I first got sober. And those, when you put those new, you take the bad, bleak, the sky is falling glasses, which I think the sky kind of is falling, and you put on the better pair of glasses of awareness and attention and curiosity, you see these little things all around that give you a lift or give you hope or whatever. You know what I'm talking about?
I do. And it's interesting because, I mean, first of all, it's tangible, right? It's so much easier to get your heart around a daffodil than it is around the fact that we might already have all the technology we need to go net zero in the planet. But it also kind of reminds me of like a certain kind of writing advice that, like, to be specific with the things that you write and to zone in on some of those details is also what makes a piece of work memorable and meaningful. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Exactly. And the other James saying, a writer is someone on whom nothing is lost, you know, that you're really, really paying attention. And that also, I've always told my writing students, write what you'd love to come upon. And if those little moments and little observations, very, very carefully detailed physical descriptions are what you love to come upon when you're reading, then start to develop that as part of the work you present to the world.
So your book has 11 different essays about love, and they're everything from a church community meetings to a trip to Cuba with your husband to you talking about a sick friend. And you had one line in there in something, I think it was near the end, saying love is a call and response, that really struck me. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I could write about that, I think, better, but love is a call and response. There's a saying in recovery that the opposite of addiction isn't sobriety, but connection. And I feel that the grief on so many of our hearts is the isolation. And God, you know, 4 years of COVID, or 3.5 years of COVID, just so heightened that sense of being with our own brains, our own rattled pinball minds all day, every day, but also the all these things that via the internet that seem to connect us, really keep us so isolated from the rich experiences of life so often. I mean, there are things that are so great about the way we connect online, but in our isolation, one thing that has saved me, and this has been true my entire life, is, well, to be able to pick up the 200-pound phone and to tell someone you're not okay, or you feel really scared by your level of isolation and separateness and lack of connection. And the person that you call, in my experience, never says, oh, for Pete's sake, why don't you just go take a walk? Or, oh my God, you have more friends than any, you know, what they say is, wow, I really understand. I really get that. I felt that way a few days ago. And I thought of you, but what I did, and then they tell you what they did to, you know, to feel that umbilical connection to life again, or to one another, or to one's own self. And so in so many of the pieces that I wrote in Somehow, that's really what happens, is that there's a person in really deep isolation, like the friend Karen who's dying, or the person who is trying, the shy introvert who is trying to find a place in the what Martin Luther King called the beloved community. And how do you do that? And what's the call? What's the response? And the call is, hi. And the person says, oh, hi, what's your name? I'm Patricia. Oh, I'm Annie. And the response is, well, come in. I want you to meet a couple, you know? And it's like, you say that first word, or hi, or you say on the phone, I don't feel okay. I feel kind of scared right now. Or you, in the Hebrew Bible, and I think it's in the Psalms, but I'm not positive. The psalmist, I think, writes, it's probably David because it's so profound, but he talks about deep calling to deep. And that could be a waterfall calling to the stars, or it could be you reaching out to me and us talking about what it's really like, what the writing is really like, what the reading is really like. Deep calling to deep is the relationship of a good writer calling out to the audience. And that's love. And it's saying, you got a minute, I got a story, I think you might find it interesting. And a reader trusting particular writers enough to say, yeah, and sitting down, and then you start the process of the writer tells you a story, and somehow they've helped you care about the people or the predicament or the setting. And in deep loneliness, the last thing I've ever wanted is connection. In deep loneliness, what I want is to be left alone. I want to be like a deer at the salt lick, you know, or the cats. I've had cats that have been really badly injured before and have come through. But the thing with a cat is they don't want you to help them. You know, they want to, my cats have, they hunch over the wound, and you can tell, you have to take them to the vet eventually, but they don't want you, and you somehow put them in a box, and you take them to the vet, and the vet responds. But in every way that I thought about writing about love, someone says, are you there? Someone says, do you have a minute? Someone says, I need help. Someone says, you don't look so good. Can I get you a glass of? And then there's the response. And then there's kind of often these very small miracles that I think are pretty beautiful and pretty amazing every time they help. Like when you are completely not okay, really stuck, even whether it's writer's block or because a close friend has gotten a bad diagnosis, and you go from completely unokay to a little bit better. I would count that as a small miracle. And when I feel it, God, I'm grateful just to be a little bit better.
It seems like there's in all of your essays that are personal about you, that are about other people, that there's a sense of vulnerability that's intrinsically mm-hmm. linked to love, that even what you're saying about this call and response is like, it's so scary to let someone know that you need them or to let someone know that you love them. But also there's a lot in there about allowing yourself to be loved.
Yeah. The hardest thing we do. It's that whole last chapter about the William Blake poem that says we are here to learn to endure the beams of love. That does have to do with the willingness, the surprising willingness to be vulnerable. You know, my friend, the comedian Duncan Trussell says, when you first meet me, you're meeting my bodyguard. And to me, that's true of everyone I've ever met. And it's certainly true of me. And at some point, something gives you, often pain or exhaustion, complete exhaustion, give you the willingness to let someone in past the bodyguard to the person, not the uncurated person, the person that we don't gussy up for the public. And in that vulnerability is the possibility, and I think the only possibility, of love.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. I really liked your essay. It was called Cowboy, but what you were talking about was like at your church. I think the pastor was asking people to be like, do radical Jesus. And people didn't really know what that meant, but their first instinct was, let's create a shelter for homeless people. Let's give out food. Let's, you know, give to others who are needy. Or let's help the planet. And the pastor was like, well, this is coming from like fear and like a negativity, and that's not right. And she sent everybody home and said, think about it. And it took a while for people to figure it out. And it just ended up in this place where people were like, you know, I feel lonely. I want someone to pray with, or I'm afraid to have cooked dinner for people. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about this.
Oh, yeah, I love that story. The minister, a woman, announces the beginning of this. She says, I want to have a radical Jesus group. And a whole lot of people meet and they do what you said. They're thinking, well, we need to boycott the local right-wing hate radio station. We need showers for the homeless. We need this. We need that. But also what they also have is a lot of ideas of how it should be run, i.e. who should be in charge. And what the group would look like. And she just, the minister says, I'm exhausted by the number of things of that you want to do to fix the whole world, and by your insistence that your way of doing it would probably be the best way to proceed. And everybody go home and think about what they long for and need in their life. And people just said, half of them didn't show up again because they wanted to do the things that they thought were the priority for the church. But the half that did had thought about it. And what they were saying was, well, I'm really overweight, but I won't walk. And I'd like somebody to walk with 4 days a week. Would anyone here come walk with me? Would anyone, one man said, there's all these things on our house that are broken because my father was a handyman, but he never taught me how to do anything. And my mother was never allowed to call anyone if things were broken, and I can't fix anything. And I'm afraid to call someone. I wonder if anyone here knows how to fix things and could come over some. And, you know, three men show up or whoever, and they stay together. They bond. And the friend who told me this story, he wants somebody to keep him accountable for being present and doing less in the world and being less busy and kind of sitting around in an intentional spiritual circumstance and talking or listening and meditating. And so the minister says she'll come over and she's going to keep him accountable. And of course, every time she calls, he goes, well, I'm really too busy. It won't work for you to come over today. She says, you know what? You asked me to do this. I'm coming over. I'm going to sit on the porch. If you want to join me, that's fine. It's just so touching that everybody knows how to do things for other people and how to take care. I mean, the radical Jesus really is about taking care of the poor. That's the message. And but people are so scared to ask people to to be there for them and to help them walk through new ways of being and trying to get a little bit healthier, trying to get the house in repair, or trying to make a commitment to sitting every day with the intention of deepening your spiritual awareness or your awakening. I just loved it. I just loved it. It made me think, like, what do I need? What do I need? But I have a husband and I have a couple of best friends. And the thing is, when I got sober in the 80s, I really heard that we're as sick as our secrets. And when I feel mentally really distressed or troubled or kind of clenched, I know that I've got a secret that I'm not sharing with somebody, and that, you know, people like to go around saying, let go and let God, which just infuriates me, because if I could, I would have. But what I know I need to do is to ask someone. My son is great with this, or one of my best girlfriends, and I need to tell him. And often I feel teary because it's so embarrassing to have such bad feelings in some cases, or to feel so vulnerable, or to feel like so emotionally immature that this thing is driving me crazy, that's so stupid. And again, they never say, oh, you're kidding, ever. They feel honored for me to trust them with that secret. And that's call and response again. And that's kind of everything that's going on in the book. It's that those times when either we slip on the cosmic banana peel, or life just asserts itself and goes really south on us. And there are so many different realms of love out there that are available, that will see us through, that will heal us, that will hold us up while we flounder. And like the piece on swimming, you know, and that the world, the love in the world, this scary, dark, cold world, the love will hold us up unexpectedly and every time.
When you feel like you do have a secret and it's tearing you apart in some way, you know, even if you don't realize it right away, does writing play any role for you in either getting it out or understanding it?
Well, that's a great question. Not writing so much, but reading. Because when I'm reading somebody's book, and they're sharing a secret, whether it's fictional or memoir, and it's really deep and core to being human, and I see myself in the mirror that they're holding up, I am flooded with relief and I'm flooded with gratitude for the courage to tell that secret. And, you know, people think, oh, you say stuff that I've only thought, or I've never said that out, or whatever. But the stuff that I write, the stuff I present in my work, is stuff I know is universal, that I've been talking about for a long time with a lot of different people. The stuff that's intimate, I share with my son or Neil or a friend. But this stuff is like universal, that we're all, you know, scared sometimes. We all screw up. We're all a little screwed up. We're all really damaged in some ways. It's a long road back from certain kinds of scary childhoods. We're all floundering a lot. We all have done damage to other people that we haven't sought forgiveness for. We're holding grudges. We're really manipulative or petty or materialistic or ambitious. We're all this stuff, but we all are. And so I love to say something in a book that I haven't said before that seems really deep and universal, but that I haven't said out loud on paper. The way I say stuff out loud is usually on paper. And I love it. It's thrilling because I know I wouldn't say it if I thought there would be a backlash against me and people would stop coming to my events. But I say it because everyone I've ever said it to before has gotten it, you know, just grokked it and said, oh God, me too. I've done that. I have that. What do you do about it? Or what I've tried is, so I love it. And I do think we are as sick as our secrets, and not everybody knows all my secrets, but somebody knows all my secrets, not always the same person. And I do believe that's how we heal.
When you're saying that, you know, you're writing about these universal truths, but like maybe your deep secrets are more not something you write about, you share with these friends. Was there something in this book that brought you over the edge with one of those things that you think is embodied in this book that you haven't disclosed before?
I have to think about that. I think what I was secretly really afraid of writing this book was, you know, like the New York literati and the book reviewers in the New York, because this is a book about heart and love and soul and spirit and higher power and goodness. And it's just so not New York City. And I felt afraid a lot of the time while writing it to go as deep as I tried to go in writing about my beliefs in as they pertain to love and truth, and to say what I believe to be the truth. And but I blurted them out, and I show stuff to Neil first, Neil and the best friend, and they loved it. They never said, are you sure you want to say this? Because it wasn't stuff that was like so out there in terms of being a deep, dark secret. It was just trying to share this softer, truer human side of things that I don't think is really popular with like male East Coast book reviewers, who are mostly the book reviewers. And at some point you think, oh, the hell with it. One of the things driving this book was that I really, you know, 70, and I understand in a way I never quite did before that we're all on borrowed time, and I don't know how long I'm going to live. And I just can't be bound by what a certain kind of reviewer who prefers a lot of intellectual wordplay or literary pyrotechnics thinks of my work. It's really optional whether you read me or not. You know, there's other writers out there. And so I kind of felt like I was shooting the moon this time. It's my 20th book. I find it really hard. I find self-promotion really hard and book tours just exhausting and embarrassing. And in a perfect world, I wouldn't have to write another book. We'll have to see what life has to say about that. But I really feel like I shot the moon in terms of all those themes you mentioned in the beginning.
Well, I think that's what's so interesting about the call and response idea in here, because I also thought about how many wounded people. I mean, you're writing in the very beginning about homeless people in your area, and I think we get so wounded when we put out the call and we don't get the response. Mm-hmm. And that's mm-hmm. what breaks our hearts. And you're talking about mm-hmm. that with a book reviewer, or, you know, there's the vulnerability that we have. Like, love is a call and response, but you don't always get a response. And
no, you don't. And that's why so much of the book is also about what you do in the face of not getting the response you want, in the face of having somebody, a really dear friend, turn on you because they think that you betrayed them or you haven't treated them with the honor and equality and respect. And they got it wrong. You know, they misunderstood something, but they've turned on you and told you who they think you are, which is, you know, not a great person to be, is devastating. So a lot of the book is, how do we find our center and a safe place to land when something like that has knocked us off our perch and made us feel ways about ourselves that are really damaging and injurious. And you know, you get a bad review, and it can just throw you. I've been doing this for 46 years. I've been under book contract, and I get a bad review in a certain place, and it gets under my skin. It's devastating. Well, the question is, how do I find myself? How do I come back to thinking, well, this is like, who cares? Ideally, but that's just not me. I think you probably know that if you've read my work. But who cares? It's me. How do you find yourself when you've fallen and landed really hard? And the answer is love. And the answer is self-love. And the answer is calling someone and not minimizing what has happened or how seriously you're taking it. If I call someone, if I could tell Neil, my husband, or Sam, if I read them some lines from a bad review, and I will get bad reviews, it just comes with the territory of being a writer. They don't say, oh, for Pete's sake, Mom or Annie, or just shake it off. They understand that it's really hurtful, because when I give the world a book, it really is my best self. It's the best I could do. It's many, many drafts of everything. It's my spirit and my beingness in words. And I've handed over. And when somebody disses it, it's going to hurt, and they get it. And so they always do the best possible thing, which is to tear down the person who reviewed it and point out that the person has never been successfully published and is just a complete loser and just a jealous freak and beneath contempt. And then they go and they get me a cup of tea, or they take me for a walk, or they take me to the movies, or they just sit with me and they get it and they hate the person on my behalf. And that is just really helpful.
I want to go back to something you said about when I was asking you about if there's something in this book or what helped you with The Secrets. And you said it wasn't writing, it was actually reading. And I'm wondering, because you quote so many writers and thinkers in here, you're obviously very influenced and have a lot on the tip of your tongue about what has influenced you. But I'm curious if there was one thing that brought you the most solace when you had a secret that you read.
Oh God. You know, I think I'm older than you. I was born in 54, and the women's movement burst onto the scene when I'm 16, when the first issue of Ms. Magazine comes out, and all the books that people were talking about in Ms. Magazine were just radicalized me, like Doris Lessing. You know, and there's a woman named Marge Piercy. I don't know if you read about, remember her? God, it was so fun. I was 23 when I read my first Margaret Atwood book. It was Surfacing. And these books radicalized me. And because the women were telling secrets. They were saying, we're not going to pretend to be who you'd love for us to be anymore. And we're grief-struck and we're angry. And they started telling secrets about what they had done to look good for men, what they had done to get the acclaim of men, what they felt secretly, how it affected them. I mean, I still remember essays from, I think it was one of the first issues of Ms., that woman, the woman who spent one day going around and saying click every single time she heard something said about women that was just condescending or dismissive. It could be at the gas station, the way that the man would leap to help her and she'd go click, or the way that somebody, or even the culture, but somebody would say something that meant she wasn't as strong or capable or whatever, and she'd go click, click, click. And I started doing that. And I started to notice all around me, men that I really liked saying stuff that was diminishing or that didn't understand the depth of me and the breadth of my emotional life and spectrum. And so starting to share those secrets with other women, and women turning me on to books, and Audrey and Rich, right? Saying what is true and what it's like to be her, to be a woman, to be, you know, angry and crazy some days and not this nicely put together person that makes life better for everybody around her, but to be, you know, all the things we were told not to be, and to embrace them and like you were saying, to tell the specifics of them, to tell on other people. We were told, a lot of our families coming up in the 50s, you don't tell what's going on behind closed doors, and you don't tell the family secrets. And these women were telling the family secrets. My dad, not mine, who was the mayor of San Antonio or city in Quebec, was a molester or an alcoholic or a wife beater, or the man was in terror all the time who went out on stage and was bombastic, and they were telling the secrets. And God, it was just medicine. And that's what writing is. Like what we've been talking about is that certain kinds of writing, my life has been defined by reading. I found salvation as a child by about 4 years old. I was an early reader in the written book. But in those, as a reader, all of those years, where I found salvation is writers telling me the details of these universal emotions and human experiences. And mine and yours would be completely different. But if you started, we could just like riff for an hour on what it was like for you when you turned 13 and what it was like for me. And it was completely different and it was universal, right? And we would just be jamming. And that's what the writer is doing, the jamming with the reader. Here's the specifics of, now I didn't experience a lot of magical realism in Marin County, California, Northern California, but when I was reading those very first Isabel Allende books, and she was telling family secrets of crazy families, it was like, yes, that's exact. No one's ever said that before. That was exactly. Now my experience took place in a Safeway, not in a palace coup, but you know, the same thing, the same fear, the same thrill, the same courage, the same, you know, so sorry to go on for so long about that, but it really has defined my life, was finding in the written word, whether it was E.B. White in Charlotte's Web, or whether it was Beverly Cleary, you know, or Dr. Seuss, Madeleine L'Engle, that is where I found salvation. And that's where I find it every night. Tonight, when I get back in bed with what I'm reading, I will feel the peace of being in a world that a writer has created for me to get lost in. Because in getting lost in that writer's world, I get found again over and over and over again. And I love good writing. It is the scripture that has saved me every step of the way, saved me and thrilled me and quieted me every step of the way.
Somehow, as you said, is your 20th book. Do you still learn something about writing each time?
You know, to be honest, I really learn the same things over and over and over again, but I learn them more quickly in the process of each book. I learned that it usually doesn't go well when I sit down. I learned that I have to write just a really horrible first draft. I have to make these long lists and snippets and scribbles. And I have a clothesline in my office that my husband put up. It's only, my office is like 10 by 8, I think. And there's a clothesline going across it with clothespins on it. And I'll try a little piece of the lead or the ending or whatever, or something in the middle. And I'll clip it, I'll print it out and clip it to the clothesline. And I have been doing that for decades. It's just airing things out and making these lists and then eventually trying a first draft. And I know now it'll go very badly. And I know the only way that I'm going to get anything done is bird by bird. And I have a 1-inch picture frame on my desk that I wrote about in Bird by Bird, that all you have to worry about is whatever you can see through a 1-inch picture frame. Just write that. Tell me that much of the story. And, you know, it might be a setting. It might be a conversation in an elevator that broke down. It might be somebody having an awakening at the moment that they were considering jumping off the cliff, and instead they sit down. Whatever. I can. And so I've known all of my, you know, Bird by Bird is 30 years old. And I know the same things, and I kind of preach the same things, that you don't have to know what you're doing. No writer knows what they're doing till they've gotten a lot of it done. And so I'm not positive I could say that I learned something new, but boy, did I remember in the middle of god-awful first drafts that this is how anything I've written that anyone likes began.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Can you read a passage from an author that speaks to you or influences you as a writer?
Yeah, I was going to read a poem that is a kind of was the guiding poem for this book, because this guided me and guides me spiritually and guided this book, just that there is this goodness that catches us by surprise. So it's by Naomi Shihab Nye, and it's called Gate A4. I'm sure you've known that, read this poem a million times. Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal, after learning my flight had been delayed 4 hours, I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of gate A4 understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, one pauses these days. Gate A4 was my own gate, so I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor wailing. Help, said the flight agent. Talk to her. What is her problem? We told her the flight was going to be late, and she did this. I stooped to put my arm around the woman and spoke haltingly. Shudowa, shubiduk, habiti, stani shwe, midpad, chubit, siwi. The moment she heard my words, she knew, however poorly used. She stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for major medical treatments the next day. I said, no, we're fine. We'll get there. Just later. Who's picking you up? Let's call him. We called her son. I spoke with him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and ride next to her. She talked to him. Then we called her other son just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad, and he and she spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, they had 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling of her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade mamoul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mounds stuffed with dates and nuts, from her bag and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There is no better cookie. And then the airline broke out free apple juice from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving it, and they were covered with powdered sugar too. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing with green furry leaves, such an old country tradition. Always carry a plant, always stay rooted to somewhere. And I looked around that gate of late, and weary one of late and weary ones. And I thought, this is the world I want to live in, the shared world. Not a single person in that gate, once the crying of confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I wanted to hug all those other women too. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost.
Do you want to say anything more about that?
No, I think that poem is all I need to know on any given day. That there is love, that the same powdered sugar covers us all, that not everything is lost.
I had never heard that before. I was crying. That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft, or something you really like.
I wrote this and I felt it was like 4 pages, and now it's a paragraph. And I felt very shy about this, as you'll see why, because who am I, you know, to write about hope when I have such passionate political positions on just about everything. But I just wrote this, and I want to say it really was 2.5 pages before, and now it's a 1 paragraph. Love looks like you to me and a few others. And this is the hardest thing to believe. One thing is certain, love is our only hope. Love springs from new life. Love springs from death. Love acts like Gandhi and our pets and Jesus and Mr. Bean and Mr. Rogers and Bette Midler. Love just won't be pinned down. Love is Florence Nightingale and Coyote Trickster, who messes with us by way of his teachings about how we might possibly grudgingly awaken to the glory of life. Love is the warmth we feel in the presence of a favorite aunt, the kindness of a waitress, and the warmth of the hand that pulls us back to our feet when the loss of love has all but destroyed us. It is this stuff which any kid and most poets will tell you we experience in our hearts. I felt I felt like I shouldn't even include that. You know, it's like show, don't tell. That's the first thing you learn about writing when you're in third grade. And I thought, I shouldn't even include it. I'm just telling you what I think love is. And it goes on. But, and then I thought, you know, my son has a tattoo on his forearm that says, we never give up. And so I thought, just don't give up on it, you know. And I took those three pages and on paper, I printed them out. And I sat with them. And it's all first draft, just really fluid. It's like the rich, wet clay you pull from the river and plop onto the table and you start working with it. And I took a lot of it out. I took a lot of it out. And then I left it there and kind of held my breath to see what Neil and the best friend of my editor made of it. And they didn't say anything awful. And I asked him later, he said, oh, I love that. So that was probably the most, the paragraph I felt shyest about publishing.
Where do you write?
I write at this tiny, funny little desk that some people built for me that was on our patio, but it has lots and lots of brick and very, very high ceilings. And it's 10 by, I think, 8, but I think truly it's really 7. And I have a fabulous, extremely light pink desk that I got for free on Craigslist and up in Petaluma, which is about an hour away. She was just giving it away. And it's fabulous. And I have paper all over and I can see out the windows.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
Oh, I go into the living room and I put on MSNBC.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
Usually Neil or one of two very best friends. And I read their stuff for them. And we have a deal. We're as honest as we can be. And I know they love my work anyway, so it's not going to be harsh. But, you know, one of them might say, I know I'm going to love this, but they might say, I think the beginning should be at what's at the bottom of page 2. And I think your ending is 7 pages before you actually stop.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Well, I think I sort of answered that. I take it really hard and seriously, and I cry and I fall apart. And then I call or tell Neil or Sam, and then they join me in just completely hating the person that rejected me and helping me plan revenge. That's the Christian way.
What is your favorite word?
Meadow.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
Oh, thank you. I love talking about writing and reading with smart women.
If you like today's show with Anne Lamott, author of the nonfiction book Somehow, Thoughts on Love, check out my interview with Melissa Phoebos on her memoir, Abandon Me. We talked about turning painful life experiences into art, how writing memoir can be a pathway for compassion for our past selves, and why we sometimes choose what isn't best for us, and how writing can reframe that behavior. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 450 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Claire Massoud, Steve Almond, and Adele Waldman. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft, a dialogue on writing, a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.